not known Dr. Ruiz prior to yesterday, and I'm a little embarrassed about that, because being a Latino, being somebody who is very interested in issues of culture, primarily culture of PCT and culture with regard to parent-child interactions and families and maltreatment, I don't know how it is that we have not encountered each other since we live in the same city, and we do very, very connected types of things. So, and I want to just briefly introduce Dr. Nadine Ruiz, who is at Professor Emeritus at CSU Sacramento, California State University of Sacramento, who will talk about, as is evidenced by the title behind me, about Latino families and cultural and linguistic resources. So, Dr. Ruiz.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here and wonderful to be learning more about PCIT during these last couple days. I've got to say also the tone of this conference, it's so pro-social, it's so warm. I was going to say it's so left thumb, but that's kind of, I can't use that metric anymore. But anyway, it's been wonderful to be here. I'm very appreciative. I'm a teacher, and I began as a bilingual teacher, an elementary bilingual teacher, in 1977 in the Central Valley, and after a while I became a teacher trainer at, actually a little bit at UC Davis, Sacramento State University, took a leave from Sacramento State to go to Stanford and reopen their elementary program. It had been closed since the late 50s, made sure that everyone graduating from the Stanford elementary program had the ability to get the bilingual authorization on their credential. And along the way, I did research, and I continue to do research, and the main area of my research is in something called bilingual special education. So this is education for children who are English learners and have been identified as special needs, and the biggest category would be in what we can broadly call language learning disabilities. The anchor study for the beginning of my research was also in the Central Valley. It was in those days, it was called a communication handicap class, but it was a classroom for children with severe language delays and disorders. And this was one of the first bilingual special education classrooms where actually there was a dual language approach to instruction. There were a few down in LA, and this one was up in Northern California. And all 10 of the children were Latino, 9 were Mexican American, 1 was Puerto Rican. And the interesting phenomenon in that classroom, I spent 2 years there looking at the way language and learning worked in the classroom. And it turned out that there was a range of disability or non-disability. So of those 10 children, 3 absolutely had no sort of language learning disability. We still are doing a very poor job in distinguishing between a second language learner set of phenomena from a language learning disability. It's still a problem. But within those 10 children, there were 4 children that very obviously had a biologically based language learning delay. And so these were 8-year-olds and 9-year-olds that spoke like 3-year-olds and often very unintelligible 3-year-olds. But what was true of every group of children in that study was that depending upon the instructional context, depending on the way that was constructed, we either saw the upper range of what children could do with language or we saw the lower range. And that was true also with the children that had these severe biologically based language delays. At that time, we had a research project from the California Department of Education, and it was called very blandly a special education demonstration project. But when I began to return to our research group and talk about what I was finding, a colleague said, well, I think we need to change the name of our program, our research program. What if we call it, because it's all about looking for that optimal learning environment? And I said, well, you know, it's theoretically sound. I think that's good. I think it's also a little boring. And he said, well, wait a second. Think of the acronym, Optimal Learning Environment, OLE. So we went with it. Sorry about the acronym, Sam. Oh, okay. And then when we began to work with migrant optimal learning environment, it was MOLE. So that was like a really cool one. But the connection I see very, very powerfully here between PCIT and what we have been doing in OLE classrooms in both special education and general education is we're about optimizing that teaching and learning context so that we can see the upper range of what children and parents can do and teachers, and so we can see accelerated development. So I'd like to go ahead and start with a story of a child and a teacher that epitomizes, I think, this powerful impact of context. And we began work with special education teachers, then moving into general education, and we would have conferences like this. We'd have what we called an academy, and we'd gather together teachers for about 3 to 5 days, talk about OLE strategies, instructional strategies that would help us create those optimal conditions. And one of the teachers in one of our first institute was Tomas Enguídanos from San Francisco, and he had a special day class for children ages 8 through 10, and so the children had language learning disabilities and also behavioral disorders. And so Tomas went from our OLE institute back, and he began to put into place instructional strategies that helped us create these optimal contexts for learning. And he also put into place some assessment strategies. And one of the assessments that we often use in OLE classrooms is something called the monthly writing sample. And that's nothing more than when we gather together our students and we ask them what they've learned about good writing that last month, and then we chart that, and then we talk about what we're going to write about, and then children sit down and write. So Tomas goes back to his classroom, his special day class. He implements instructional strategies, these assessments. And then what we did, and Anthony talked about this yesterday, and it's a very exciting piece for me, what do we do about collaborations after we have conferences like this? And in OLE, we have what we call collaborative meetings where teachers bring the work of their students and we sit and discuss them. So this institute happened in this summer. Now it was April, and it was Tomas's turn to share what was happening. And he said, I've made a big mistake. And mistake happens to be that I am not communicating to parents what is really happening now that we've instituted OLE in the classroom. And so he told us this story. He told us a story about Arturo. Arturo was in his class. Now, these series of assessments were done when Arturo was about 8 and a half. Now, in Tomas's class, he's around 9 and a half, almost 10. And you can see as you look at those results, that basically in terms of literacy and language, Arturo came out about the kindergarten level. And whether those tests were done in English or Spanish, that's what he came out with in terms of performance. Do look down to the test of visual motor integration. That's an age level score, so you'll see that in just a bit. But the key comments from the psychologists were that this is a child that has low self-esteem, doesn't read. What's not there is this is a very much a child that would be referred to PCIT if he were in the language in the age range, because he spent a lot of time under the table. He was hit other children and kicked. So Tomas told us the background about Arturo, and then he showed us Arturo's first monthly writing samples. So these are unedited samples that I know if I go into an OLE classroom, they're all posted on the wall. And if it's June, I can go over there and I can look at, for example, Susan's September, October, November, December, every one of those unedited monthly writing samples so we can see progress. So this is his first one, and he's 9 and a half, and yes, that's scribbling. But the interesting thing is Arturo could always read that to you. So if you went up and said, well, what does that say? He would say, and you can see the translation up there, but he would say, that said, that scribble, a mí me gustan los Power Rangers porque están bonitos y buenos. Okay, so that was his September writing sample. Let's look at October. So, and this says, a mí me gustan los Power Rangers. So what I'd like you to do right now, I know some of you are, we want to talk about literacy experts, but what you are absolute experts in is looking in any sort of positive development growth, whether it's in a child or a teacher. And so I'd like you to turn to someone at your table and talk about where you see growth between September and October sample. And one other thing, we'll have a signal just because we've got kind of a wide room. So if you see anyone raise their hand, that's the sign to finish your conversational turn and raise your hand so we can all kind of come back here. Okay, so turn and talk to someone at your table. Where do you see growth? Okay, thanks. And so we can think in terms of development, in terms of conventions, and also his voice as a writer. So could I get just someone to say what sort of progress? Great, over here. What did you see? Absolutely. So Dr. Shin was saying she saw real evidence of, you know, what a wonderful artist, especially in the first one. But and then he used that fine motor integration for letters the second time. So this was big. Scribbling, you know, at age 9 1/2. And this happens often in OLE classrooms. And teachers don't say anything. They just say, let's get to work. So we've got letters. Something else. Anything else that you notice as far as progress? Yes. So absolutely. The second sample actually had the text match the picture. And again, it's kind of incredible that a child can get through our school system and not know that there should be a match between what you're writing about and pictures. I think it's the ditto phenomenon, you're working with little reductionist pieces of language instead of whole text. There happens to be a second October sample, and if you read Spanish, you can start to see. There you go. Let me show you his November sample. Arturo said he wanted to do it in English, and so those are a bunch of wrestlers. I don't know if you can notice, those are turkeys dressed up as wrestlers, and it's in English, right? Say no to Mr. Fuji, say no to Yuko-sama, say yes to Hulk Hogan, so you go. Let me show you January. Again, these are all unedited, so those of you who speak Spanish can see that conventional beginning, right? Había una vez, once upon a time. So now we're looking at a story that has that conventional beginning. There's action, there's a crash, you know, at the end, you know, someone goes home, so there's a beginning, middle, and end to his story. Let me show you March. One of the Olay stories, now he didn't do that, I should say, oh gosh, darn, oh but wait, look, he did that, all right, wow. I'm gonna reverse the order of those next time. I'm absolutely ordered. This is the first time I've done that. Okay, now I get, thanks. Good feedback. this is from Carmen Lomas Garza, who's a wonderful Chicana artist. And then a book publishing company put together her paintings, and there are scenes from her childhood. And it's a bilingual book called Family Pictures or Cuadros de Familia. And so Tomas was using this in the classroom, and this was his March sample, and the thing is, that's not traced. He actually, Arturo drew that very big and we shrunk it down for this. You can read the story, once again, conventional beginning, our research with children with language learning disabilities and their story schema. Many times when they're retelling a story or answering a set of comprehension, they don't talk about the internal reaction of characters, but we can see that Arturo is doing that. But then Tomas, the teacher, brought us up to April, and he said, "So this is where I realized my error." And it turned out that all this was happening, and he had a conference with Arturo's parents. And they sat down, and Arturo's parents said, "You know Arturo's never going to learn to read and write. We know that he has daño cerebral, he has brain damage." We used to talk about minimal brain dysfunction in terms related to learning disabilities. And they had received all those messages. And so that's when Tomas said, "What have I been doing? I have not been sharing with Arturo's parents what's been going on." Here is his April sample. When it was time to do monthly writing sample, Tomas gathered all the students together and said, they went through it. And Arturo said, "I'm going to write an ode to the lizard." They had been reading lots of Pablo Neruda odes, the Nobel poet laureate from Chile, who has wonderful odes to love, but he also has an ode to a spoon and an onion. So anyway, this is Arturo's poem. Now he said, "Tomas, I want to go write on the computer." And he went over to the computer for 2 hours, didn't budge. So remember, the psychological report said he can't do anything more than 10 minutes. I have the final poem here, but I can assure you, those of you who speak Spanish, that you could have read it in its entirety. And we'll read a little bit of it. Oda lagartijo. El lagartijo es negro como la oscuridad. Oscuridad como una cueva, como palo quemado, como madera negra, como chamara negra. Oda lagartijo, es blanco como un barco, es blanco como una rosa, como polvo blanco, un jarro blanco, como una camisa blanca. Oda lagartijo, se mueve como una víbora que va a estar lista para agarrar un animal que le va a matar, como un hilo que tuerce, como un papel que se hace círculos. Oda lagartijo, la lengua azul como un mar, como un papel azul, como cielo. So Tomas looked at that and he said, "You know, the school's doing some publishing. You want to publish it, put it in there," and Arturo did. He eventually, after going through a very less than optimal junior high special ed, where we thought he would get stuck, he eventually got out of special education and graduated high school with honors. So he, yes, the powerful effect of an optimal context for teaching and learning. So today what I'd like to do is present the research, much in the way that Vilma talked at the beginning. So yes, it would have been great if we could have begun PC from a Latino perspective, you know, looking at the research. But what we're doing now, we have this incredible intervention program, and we're going to look at the research on Latino families, primarily Mexican-American families, and see then how it can moderate and how it can positively influence what we're doing in PCIT. I do want to acknowledge some specific stressors that happen to Latino families, and again, engage in this ongoing conversation. What I know about PCIT and about this conference is that there's such tremendous background knowledge here. I was lucky enough to be in two workshops yesterday put on by the Children's Guidance Center and the Children's Institute. Just fabulous. So I know there is a lot of background knowledge here. What I'd like you to do is just in front of you, number 1 through 5 vertically, and all of these statements are related to research with Latino families. So use your academic reading, your background, your personal experiences. Would you go ahead and then just, these are all related to research, but some may be false, all right? So predict whether these are true or false. The first one, number 1, is research overwhelmingly documents that Latino parents have high educational and career aspirations for their children, true or false. Second, Mexican-American children and youth who maintain their use of Spanish have higher achievement and are less likely to drop out. That's number 3, Spanish-English code switching is almost always a sign that speakers are losing their proficiency in Spanish. 4, the more Mexican origin youth self-identify as American, the greater their ability to navigate multiple contexts, the greater buffer from stressors, fewer internalizing symptoms. And the 5th one, Mexican indigenous children and families suffer more severe discrimination in the school setting than other Mexican origin groups. So, real quickly, thank you for doing this just alone, but So you got those five, true or false? I think we got to go ahead and just compare, turn and talk with the neighbor real quick. We'll use the same signal. Just kind of compare your true and false. Okay, thanks. We will revisit. Let's talk about Latinos, parents, expectations, and aspirations. Let's go ahead and begin also with the teachers' expectations and aspirations. These are samples from an interactive journal from Carolina Oropesa's bilingual kindergarten class. And these samples are from Limari. Limari started kindergarten at 4 years old. She's from a migrant background. But what we found in Olay and Carolina and specifically, that in the interactive journal at kindergarten, if you put those lines there, it's a lot like a baseball field. If you build it, they will come. If you put those lines there, something will go on those lines by these kindergarten. And we actually have Olay preschools same way. And so we see that Limari has drawn and written. And of course, we can't, her name's on the bottom line, but we can't really read that. But as Olay teachers always say is, wow, look what you've drawn and written, tell me about it. And it turns out that that was a picture of apples and grass. And so the second part of an interactive journal is the teacher writing a question back. And then the third part is either an oral response or a written response. So that's how Limari started, talking about grass and apples. Now let's go ahead and go to March in her kindergarten year, and we can read what she's written there. And Carolina asked Limari, well, boy, I see that you've written and drawn a lot. What does that say? And it turns out that that's an airplane, and that's Limari's father flying to Mexico. So in the next, Carolina turns over, and Ole, we turn over the page. We like to keep that first page just what the children can do, because that's what we see their level. And on the second one, we might help them stretch out words. And she asks, why did your father go back to Mexico again? And if you speak Spanish, I bet you can read pretty much all of that. Acomodar sus papeles. So to fix his papers, his documentation papers. So what Carolina has done has shown her expectations that every child in her classroom is going to bring a rich set of lived experiences. And if we make space, we never assign a topic, okay? Not even to our preschoolers. If we make space, those children bring those experiences there. Let me show you a couple more. This is her grandfather in a coffin who has died. And in those cases, Carolina does much more than a three-part sort of interaction. And this interaction shows how much the child knows about where her grandfather lives in Mexico. Is it her father or mother's side? So again, the world knowledge that comes out of this little one who has just turned five is impresses us. I wanted to go ahead and finish up with the May sample. So remember, Limari's just still in kindergarten and going off to first grade, and you can see lots of punctuation floating around there. And what she wrote about, again, we don't give topics, she says, Diosito nos está ayudando. So the natural question is, well, what is God helping us with? And who knew, unless we made space for it, she writes back, no decir maldiciones, not to curse. Who knew that Limari had a cursing problem in kindergarten, but looks like it's being handled just fine. Anyway, once again, this shows us what, when we make space, this shows us what children value, the knowledge that they that they bring. I just wanted to mention at the end of, so it'll be posted on the PCIT, I'll put this whole presentation there, but I also have, we have 12 optimal conditions that derive from the research and are about setting up these optimal environments, and so they're on the PowerPoint. But I just want to show that we, these all come from the research, but offering students choice, making sure it's student-centered, number four, that they're very active, they hold the pen, we don't, to create those optimal learning environments. Just to show you where Limari is now in fourth grade, this is a monthly writing sample, just like the Arturo one. Again, this is unedited, and it is in English. She's fast becoming one of those balanced bilingual children where there's no marker in English and Spanish and the other language. She introduces herself. Look at the cool spelling at the second paragraph. We were in the car for two straight days. Pretty good for a fourth grader. But I love that even in an assessment, she tries to bring her voice and identity as a writer. The city of Houston, Texas is the most beautiful place I've ever been in the dark. I love it. I think that if you ever go be there in the dark, then you will know why I said these beautiful things to you. So again, that voice, that identity, and we'll talk about identity in just a little bit. So Carolina has seen all these things with interactive journals, so now what she's decided to do, because she would also, when parents would come and sit down and talk about what was happening, we learned our lessons from Tomas, she would share their interactive journals. Or when she would do a parent visit, she'd go with the child's interactive journals. And the parents began to say, well, this is something we can do. So let me go ahead and show you. Well, first of all, let's say, here's what the research says. And anything from Claude Goldenberg, he used to be at Long Beach State, he's at Stanford now. If you go onto his faculty website, he's really good about putting PDFs of those articles, so you can just click it and get his article. Any research by Ron Gallimore, who's from the UCLA Med School, he's emeritus. Any research from Leslie Reese, look at all these Southern California people, or ex-Southern California people, Leslie Reese from Long Beach State, anything. Concha Delgado Gaitan, she's emerita from UC Davis. Every study that they've done, and they've done, especially the Reese, Goldenberg, Gallimore, have done longitudinal studies that we were talking about. They're so important. So where you follow the children for 10, 15 years, overwhelmingly it shows that the parents, Latino parents and Mexican-American parents, have high aspirations. So let me just go now to a parent. So this is a parent of Susana in Carolina's class. Carolina has looped up with her first and second graders. And they have just lost their father. The mother has just lost her husband. So Susana's father has just recently passed away. And they're doing a mother-child interactive journal. I love the thought bubbles on the picture up on top. So is mom going to let me stay after class? So it's basically she's asking if she can stay after class in her teacher's classroom. I'd like to go ahead and read in Spanish, and please follow along in English what this says, because I want you to hear the tone and the cariño. So this is her mother writing back. Querida Susana, hija. Primero que nada, déjame decirte la alegría que me dio al recibir tu mensaje. Es una buena idea poder comunicarnos por medio de cartas, ya que no tenemos mucho tiempo para decirnos cuánto nos necesitamos. Hija, te quiero mucho. Daría todo lo que tengo para estar contigo todo el tiempo, pero como ves, no es posible. Hija, el poco tiempo que tengo lo vamos a aprovechar de este si estoy segura. And then she talks about the permission. I'll do this last part in English. About what you're asking me about as far as permission to stay, let me go ahead and talk to your teacher first. So, and she says, well, little one, give it all you've got for the studies so that in the future you have the opportunity to choose what you want to be. Those are my dearest wishes. I love you a lot. Little kisses from Mama. So here we see an application very clearly of the aspiration and the expectation. Also, we're going to talk about something called educación, But many Mexican-American families distinguish between los estudios, which is a lot of time what we mean in English, so los estudios, and she said, ponte ganas en el estudio, right? And then there's something more broadly called educación. But we've also found, and this was a study a while ago that Concha and I did, is that, and what we saw enacted by Tomas, the schools in general have been really bad as far as giving the specifics to parents on how to enact what they need to do to make sure those aspirations are realized. Enter PCIT. So this is wonderful that you have such concrete ways to tell parents, to guide parents in how to bring that relationship back into balance. So it's exactly what schools need to be doing more of, and some are. I want to talk a little bit about other cultural patterns that are in the research. And along with this PowerPoint, I have a reference list where I've asterisked the articles that I think are particularly related to PCIT. And one of the things that we did in our collaborative meetings after we had our Olay Institutes is often we would bring an article that we would all read together, because who has time to do that now that you're out of your master's programs and your PhD programs? So I put asterisks on ones that I think would be great to come to read together and talk about, again, how we can integrate what we know about the research into PCIT. So something very, very strong in the research. And I love these two articles by Hagenseth. Familismo, so the emphasis on family, commitment to family, solidarity, attachment to both the nuclear and extended family. It's the primary source of support. Your obligation is to ensuring the well-being of the whole family, less so to individually. It's called familismo. Now, you'll never hear that among the population. Only researchers do that, and I think they do it in Spanish because saying that in English is really hard for me. So familismo. So people don't go around saying, oh, bueno, aplicamos mucho familismo en nuestra familia. You're never not going to hear that. But it's a term that we use to talk about that strong cultural current. So it's out there, and I do realize that you, of course, are getting children and parents who have gone through such tremendous stress, and that those cultural values may not be very present at that moment. But I've also seen what I know is that PCIT, once you bring that relationship back into balance, then we want you to know that these cultural values are there. And about culture, and Sam was talking about this in Velma too, we have cultural patterns. Then how much any individual ascribes to that cultural matter, well, that's, you got to find that out. But the good thing about cultural patterns is that we're all, especially these strong ones like the importance of family, we're all aware of them. And even if you didn't practice them right in your particular family, it's definitely part of the culture. I saw a potato chip billboard on the way here. What it said something, juntos disfrutamos mejor. So together, and it was a family eating potato chips. So even if, you know, if the advertisers can get familismo, then we can get that too. So that's a very, very important part of the culture. And interesting, the second reference there by Hagenseth and ISPA, they've come up with a Mexican parenting questionnaire that they're using in their research, and definitely finding when those cultural values are more present than either that performance is enhanced. And they're working a lot with preschool children and primary age children. As someone trained in educational ethnography, which is the research arm of cultural anthropology and discourse of communication, sometimes I look at these instruments trying to reduce culture, and, you know, I look at them very carefully. We have to combine this sort of research with the very difficult ethnographic home studies, the kind that Olga Vasquez from UC San Diego, spending years in a Mexican-American community, being at the table where the mothers were giving their consejos, their advice, or cuentos. We need to also look at those studies, but this group of people is doing good work, and these are studies that I think are worth reading as we think about what the research says about families and PCIT. There's also educación, very strong, and I talked about how that's different from los estudios. Educación is about moral education. It's about good manners. It's about respectful. So you hear PCIT and what's happening there, and the congruence culturally with improving the behavior of children. It's a deep source of embarrassment, you know, when you don't have children that aren't bien educados, right? So the fact that PCIT can bring that back, I think, is a very, very important part that we have to look at it. Cariño, so affection. A couple studies have shown that when they just bring their cameras and film Mexican-American mothers and their children playing around toys, they were saying that most of their discourse took the form of imperatives or commands. But they were given in a very affectionate way, cariño. So cariño comes when you use the, what we heard that in Susana's mother's diary, hija or mijo, my daughter, my child. So you can give very direct behavioral sort of imperatives and directives, but with that cariño, and that is something that you can bring. Now, unlike familismo that you'd never hear in the community, people talk about educación. They talk about cariño. Another discourse event found in many families is consejos, so these kind of spontaneous homilies, and I'm sure a lot of people here at the conference have had these consejos given to them by older women, older men, abuelitos in their family. That's a very important part of the cultural context of Latino families, and it's something that we need to know about when we hear that, when our parents, when we're having those debriefing meetings with our parents, and you hear something about educación, you hear something about consejos, what we want to do is really make sure that we're helping elevate those cultural patterns. Let's switch from cultural patterns to language. Let me go ahead and use another example of a child from special education. This little boy is Jose. He was in a Northern California Resource Specialist program. Turned out there were 14 boys in this one class. They all supposedly all had language and learning disabilities. What really happened is they were in a short-term bilingual program, first and second grade, transitioned into English, didn't do well, were given the psychological test in English, did poorly, given the psychological tests in Spanish, sometimes normed in Peru, give poorly, and you have that discrepancy between cognitive potential and what they were doing. So we began to work with Jose's teacher, and she said, and we began to work with a strategy called Writer's Workshop. And she said, now, of course, Nadine, I'm going to have them do all their stories in English because they're supposed to be in English now. And I said, well, you know, the research has shown us we've got to give them choice. And she said, oh, but really, you know, they're supposed to be ready for fourth grade. And we said, well, would you just kind of trust us here, that again, that important trust relationship, and let them choose. So Jose's first book was El Niño Que Era Pobre, the little boy who was poor. And you see in a lot of these books, the familismo, this was about a little boy who found a treasure chest and gave it to his dad so he can buy a car. Here's the second book, and of course the teacher is looking cross-eyed at us, and she said, well, Jose, this is good that he wrote another book, because all of these children, when we did the initial interviews, are you writers? No. Are you readers? No. Can you give us a name of a book you've read? No. So she was happy that he was writing, but here we go once again in Spanish. His third book, though, this is part of a draft. Those of you who speak Spanish, Spot Goes to the Jungle. You know what that says? Spot goes to the jungle, right. So this is, he's using all his language resources, his Spanish phonology to write that word. And this is his draft. You can see he's already thinking about how he's going to do the different pages. And it turns out in this research, OLE special research, resource specialist program, that once you have your draft, you go to author's chair and you sit down, and the teacher's over there with these little post-its you see on the left-hand side there. And children get to say what they liked about the story and any questions. So the teacher's over there giving these, taking notes on the post-its, and usually gives it to the student, and the student sometimes pays attention to him, sometimes not. But this is an author by now. This is Jose. And he, on his own, took every one of those post-its, and he wrote it, he put them down, and he wrote next to him how he was going to revise. And for, that's a really hard skill. Editing's, yeah, it's, we can do editing. Revision, we know from the research, is a harder skill in literacy. So I did want to say The first one, they asked if he would have a dedication, and he said, "I'm going to dedicate it to my family or to Elva." And Elva was the instructional aide, and she was from the community. And I wanted just to kind of piggyback on something that I heard yesterday from the Children's Institute presentation, who have parent coordinators who go in to the homes. And they were talking about sometimes the kind of the first steps, the breakthrough, are with those parent coordinators. And we saw the same thing in Olay, because especially when sometimes the teachers didn't actually live in the community, but the paraprofessionals always did. And sometimes those first breakthroughs were with the teacher, the paraprofessional who was there. So he did some co-editing with a friend. This is his book, Spot Goes to the Jungle. And he dedicated to the aide. So again, that's really important as we're talking about extended families and extended community members, really important is where we see the first growth of children. His next one, he wanted to do in Spanish, but he said, "Oh, it's about WWF, I have to do it in English." I love how he's playing with genres. So it's about WWF, but it's in the form of a letter to his little brother. Unexpected things that happened in research. We had given every classroom a copying machine so we could collect our data, but then the kids used the copying machine for their stories. But it was this last one, one of our research assistants went in and said, "Jose, hey, you're working on another story." And he goes, "Oh, beyond stories, they've been reading lots of Shel Silverstein poetry, and that's his poem. There's a monster in my closet. He likes it because it's so dark in there. He sits all over my clothes, and his face goes into my underwear." And if you can get the word underwear, you know, in a poem, then you're doing pretty well. So so what does this say about language? Gosh, there's a great summary article about a lot of the school, the importance of primary language. But here we go. Children and adolescents who maintain their Spanish, especially in the second generation, there you see, report higher self-esteem, higher educational career aspirations, less likely to drop out. We know this in bilingual ed. The strongest predictor of how well a child's going to do in English is not age, it's not youth. It's how much formal schooling you have in your L1. Strong, study after study. So again, we need to, and Anthony mentioned this, did my heart good to, you know, see that you have actual workshops in Spanish. You know, that there's just no better message to parents about the strengths of their home language. Just a quick aside, we spoke only Spanish to my two children, Roberto and Elena, but when Elena was 1 year old, she contracted meningitis and became deaf. And at that point I asked, is there any way we can find some, you know, sign in Spanish? At that point, we didn't know about Mexican sign language, and so we abruptly switched to English, and it was devastating. So you never, ever want to tell a parent to change the language. You want to reinforce that language that they're using at home. And I also heard that some people are doing PCIT with deaf parents or deaf children, so big thumbs up. I want to just go back to Jose's classroom quickly, because it turned out the way we did this one Olay project was they were 3 weeks in the special ed classroom, and then they'd go 3 weeks into the regular ed program, and Elva, the aide, would go there and just try to support them. Well, it turned out that the optimal learning environment was special ed. And I don't know about you, but still in some schools, RSP to the kids, to the peer culture, they say that stands for really stupid people, right? But instead, what would happen is all Jose and his peers were in their regular classroom, and they said, "Oh, please, Elva, can we go back? We want to go back, you know, into the special education classroom." And she said, "Well, you know, you have to do your work here." She's trying to keep them quiet. And she said, "If you finish all your work, you can write letters to the teacher about how you want to go back to special ed." And so they did. And, of course, these are kids that have some behavioral challenges. And so they're sneaking out and picking flowers off, you know, outside the classroom and making a big envelope. And this is one that says, "Dear Mrs. B, we're asking you to let us go back. There's a lot of noise here. It's boring. We're asking you to go back because you're good to us. We're asking this from the heart." So, you know, they were doing everything. But let me just go. This was another letter, and the translation is below, but it goes, "Para señora, por favor, tráenos para atrás. Quiero venir para atrás porque aquí está aburrido y yo quiero hacer mi cuento. Por favor, llévanos para atrás. Help. Okay. All right, which brings us to code switching. And you know, part of what we do too is when we work with families is to get rid of any deficit notions. And it turns out there are deficit notions about code switching, but the literature says, oh my goodness, this is a very highly developed skill. And the people are most proficient in two languages do the hardest type of code switching, which is over to my right, the intra-sentential code switching, so within the sentence. So sometimes we just do a single word, right? But the second example, se pudre, and then it smells a lot. It rots, and then it smells a lot. That kind of code switching is really tough. It's rule-governed. This is absolutely rule-governed. And in fact, here's an example of one of the rules. You can't, in code switching, you can't violate syntactic rules of other language, of either language. So the first code switch under there is perfect. I told him that, pa que la trajera ligero. I told him that, this is a Puerto Rican from the East Coast. I told him that so he would bring it back fast. Not okay. You would never hear this one. El man que came ayer wants John comprar a car nuevo. Right? All of you Spanish speakers out there, you'd never hear that. It's too short, and it also breaks a rule. And you can do this if you put the whole thing in Spanish. El hombre que vino ayer quiere que Juan, you don't say comprar, right? Quiere que Juan compre, right? So, for example, yesterday the workshops in the afternoon were completely in Spanish. They worked very hard to keep in Spanish. I bet you the same people here, though, are code switching like mad because there are, it's typical of people that have this dual proficiency. And it's been so studied, these are the research studies on children's code switching. You can actually predict when children are going to switch from English and Spanish. And I'll just go to the lower one when Andres was the one who said help. When he switched from Spanish to English, he was trying to get attention. He was trying to put some emphasis on there. And I've done some work actually in preschool classrooms for children with severe language disabilities, and they follow the same rules. So very, very important to know that code switching is a highly developed skill. One other interesting thing that I heard yesterday when we presented a case study of a mother, a Latina mother and child, and at first, at the beginning stages of PCIT, the child would speak to the mother in English, and what the clinicians noticed that by the end, he was using much more Spanish. And you could see here was PCIT through that mode, bringing the child and the parent and the child together again linguistically and producing those bilingual children like Lee Marie. As I say, there are other research, we're just kind of going through the surface, on these incredible language resources that children have in our Latino communities. Now, excuse me, just want to just go through here and get to talking about identity. So here we go, and I love this first study, and again, it'll be posted because it was down here in LA, but here, bottom line, the stronger the ethnic identity in Mexican origin youth, okay, so if they use terms like Mexican, even a pan-ethnic term like Mexican-American, the greater the ability to navigate those multiple contexts, the greater buffer from stressors. So we need to be reading this research because it might not go along with what we would think common sense, but every study is showing the stronger that ethnic identity is or that bicultural identity. So those are things that we really want to support in our practice. Now, I also wanted to say we're always about extending the repertoire, whether it's linguistically or in terms of identity. So, yes, we know that code switching is rule governed, but do we want all our children eventually be able to hold a workshop that we saw yesterday completely in Spanish? Absolutely. So we're always about extending that repertoire. And someday we need to talk about I'm old, I cannot use the word Spanglish, because when I was going through my PhD program, minors in linguistics, that was pejorative, but we called it either Chicano Spanish or Spanish of the Southwest, and that's very typical, and it's, there's no sort of deficit there. It's the language that we use in our homes and the communities, but yes, we're about extending that to standard Spanish. And in terms of identity, we're also very much about adding on the identity of a scholar. This is Tony. He happened to be in a wonderful fifth grade class in the Central Valley, and it's his picture up as a historian, and he talks about how he has, and he's from a migrant background. This is his first year in an all-English class, and he talks about different expository paragraphs that he has written. Just one line: history is important to Antonio because you can learn about important people and what they did to change in just a little bit. Published works by Antonio include. So you can see this addition and extending of a repertoire of identity. Specific challenges. Racism. This is a child in Carolina's class. She's 7 years old. She's writing letter strings just like Lee Marie. That was September. And so Carolina just asked, you've written a lot, why don't you read it to me? And it turns out it's about her brother and she going to school. And this always looks like we've made it up, but this is the same child. This is Diana in May, and this is her interactive journal. And it says, yesterday my father told me that I shouldn't play anymore with my friend who's white, because one day my brother and I, we went to the store, and a white man said, to his friends, that to me and my brother, they were, the police were going to take us because we're Mexican. And my brother heard this, I didn't. The stress of racism, and then here you see Carolina bringing up identity just naturally. She asked, how did you feel? Diana says, very badly. And then at the very end, she says, you know, we Mexicans, we need to be very proud. Because we are so intelligent, so bringing in identity. There are specific challenges to our Mexican-American and Latino community. Unauthorized status has a long-term effect, even in several ethnographic study done by a colleague at Sacramento State, looking at a transnational community in Stockton and Michoacan. And many mothers think that they'll come here and life will be easier, but sometimes life is tougher because they not only have the home tasks that are going on, but now are working outside the home. I want to finish with a population that we need to be talking about. So this could come from Mexico, but it's actually from Northern California, this one as well. And this was in the Sacramento Bee not so long ago. Down the windswept El Camino Real, where women in shawls push strollers and old men in cowboy hats linger on dusty benches, farm workers spill from the white contractor buses. From the main drag, it's only blocks to the fields and vineyards that sustain this peaceful town in the Salinas Valley. But there's tension in this part of John Steinbeck country. Nearly all of Greenfield's 16,300 people are Latino, and yet an ugly conflict has been brewing between longer-time residents and newcomers from Oaxaca. If you're out in schools, you know that one of the worst bullying terms now is to call someone a Oaxaca, or Oaxaco, or Oaxaquita. As a matter of fact, Ventura or Ontario School District outlawed the word. So this is a population of Mexican immigrants who do not speak Spanish as their native language, or they speak it less well. They speak Mixtec and Zapotec. And there's been this general pattern that the Mixtecos are going into farm work, so we see them very much in the Central Valley, Fresno, reaching up into Stockton as well, the northern coast, and the Zapotecos, and there are 16, 17 different groups in Oaxaca, but I'm mentioning two, have gone into the service industry. Manuel Barajas and I finished a study, I'd be glad to send you the PTF, where we went and did interviews with families and parents and teachers talking about what are the specifics of the discrimination that is being directed towards Mexican indigenous families and children. So this is something we really want you to look for, because I just read in the USA Today from the hotel that Mexican immigration is increasing again. We don't think it ever decreased for Mexican indigenous migrants, because it is so hard for them in Mexico as well. They are very much the focus of racism in Mexico, and then they come here and the same thing happens, and they are the object of bully from all groups of children. It's even Mexican-American children who don't identify as indigenous. So that is a study that I can easily send to you, but it's something that we really need to be thinking about. Now, at the same time, and I'm going to finish here, at the same time, when you read what Mexican indigenous migrant children and families are going to, yeah, your heart breaks. And at the same time, you see the cultural strength, and these are quotes that we collected for part of that study. There's a real collectivism, and Sam talked about this, very strong in Oaxaca among the indigenous. There's a, you're related, very much, of course, like Native American culture as well. And so they bring that same sense of collectivism and very specific things called el tequio, right, and comunalidad. Maybe these are some of the things that are coming up in your practice. And they bring it here to the United States, where they are suffering very much from discrimination, but at the same time, they're putting their collective strength together, and they're organizing. They're organizing terrific in terms of adults. We're not doing, we haven't seen the same thing yet, but we're starting in schools. So in the same area where we collected this information about Mexican indigenous migrants, after we left, the school started to do things to reverse that. So for example, this is a schedule that they had for a workshop talking and showed, because Oaxaca is the most, is one of the most beautiful states in Mexico. How many of you have been to Oaxaca? Gorgeous. Gorgeous. And to see that that beautiful state with all that cultural and linguistic has become a bullying term just makes no sense. And we've got to change that. And so you can see in this schedule here, it says, now let's talk about why you can be proud to be from Oaxaca. So things are beginning to change at the school. There were some quotes by a Mixtec mother there. And I just want to show you that that Mixtec mother, the bilingual kindergarten teacher, have just published this book available through Amazon that's trilingual, English, Spanish, and Mixtec. And at the back, there are some poems by her. Vilma talked about racial socialization. These poems written, a couple of them written to her son in English and Spanish, would be, I think, of great, they're of great value and great use to us. So, I'm going to go ahead and let you, when I end, go ahead and check on your true and false. And if you're just dying, if you don't know the answers, you can definitely come back to me. But what I basically want to say, and there's my email, is that I think that PCIT goals and outcomes can be positively influenced by what we know from the research in Latino families, cultural beliefs and practices. Absolutely. So we need to do that. I want to thank you, but it's just not the typical thank you. I'm going to get off the stage. I will in a second. I want to thank you, though, for what you do, because as I've come up in my different professional settings, I do know that when you bring a family back into balance, to parents and children, that we all benefit. We really do. The whole community benefits. So I want to thank you for your service, because we really do. And thanks for letting me share a couple thoughts with you today, too. Thanks.